الله وبركاته.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Three years passed since the brutal assassination of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Her widow and advocates are pushing for accountability and action from the Biden administration. Former President Trump personally defended the Saudi crown prince, who is thought to be behind this, but President Biden had promised to punish the perpetrator. The Biden administration just sufficed to come up with a report on the U.S. intelligence community's assessment of the murder, which said that MBS approved the operation in Istanbul to either capture or kill a Saudi journalist. Let's watch a report.
Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi-born, U.S.-based journalist and outspoken critic of the Saudi government, was assassinated on October the 2nd, 2018. His death shocked the world because he was killed in one of the most brutal and unusual ways possible. On the day of his assassination, Khashoggi walked into the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul. Khashoggi never came out of the building.
Where is Jamal Khashoggi?
What do we know about really what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
Turkish police insist that they know what they're looking for.
Well, the Saudis haven't been telling the truth right from the start.
Horrifying accounts have emerged of how the 59-year-old was murdered, who was responsible, and what happened to his remains. After more than 2 weeks of denials, Saudi Arabia eventually admitted that he had been killed in the consulate. The Saudis insisted that he was murdered in a rogue operation. But the international community demanded answers. Turkish investigators said video and audio recordings prove that he was tortured, killed, and dismembered. Further findings revealed that the gruesome murder was ordered by the highest level of the Saudi leadership. Later on, the United Nations confirmed it as well.
I have insisted that the killing of Mr. Khashoggi is a state killing. It is not a killing by rogue officials.
The Saudi government said 11 people had been indicted in connection with Khashoggi's killing. But a report by the CIA determined that the killing was ordered by no other than Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudis later claimed that what happened to Khashoggi was the result of a failed interrogation. Ample evidence provided by different intelligence agencies have proved otherwise. Khashoggi was once close to the Al Saud royal family and served as an advisor to the regime. But later, he fell sharply out of favor with Riyadh. In September 2017, he left the kingdom and went into self-imposed exile in the US. In his Washington Post columns, Khashoggi was highly critical of the Saudi crown prince. The case of Khashoggi has come to be known as one of the most outrageous examples of how a government targets its critics. It has also exposed the fact that Saudi Arabia's Western allies are absolutely unwilling to risk their ties and trade deals by taking a firm stance against gross human rights violations committed by Riyadh.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. Human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik is joining us out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Historian and journalist Bryce Junkers is also joining us from Hassel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let me start with Daniel. 3 years ago today, Daniel, Washington Post Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed. CIA concluded that MBS had ordered the killing. The Saudi crown prince has not faced any punishment yet. Why is that?
Well, for the main reason being that the U.S. values Saudi Arabia as a political and military ally in the Middle East, and it values it more than human rights. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It values it more than the human rights of Saudis. You know, Saudi Arabia is a very repressive regime vis-a-vis its own people, and of course, Saudi Arabia is a brutal regime towards its neighbors like Yemen and Syria. And so this does not surprise me at all. You know, while Biden promised that he would get justice for Khashoggi, he also said he was going to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's brutal war in Yemen, which he hasn't done that either. So it's business as usual. It's disappointing, but not surprising.
Okay, Bresh, Saudi Arabia is notorious for stifling voice of dissent, no matter who they could be. They even do that to their own members' royal family, like MBS. Had his own uncle, Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, who was a former interior minister and others, arrested a few years ago. So the sky seems to be the limit when it comes to oppression in the House of Saud, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, as was mentioned already, Saudi Arabia has ever since its foundation, with the support of the United Kingdom back then, been a highly oppressive, highly repressive regime that, of course, drapes itself in Islamic flag and calls itself the custodian of the holy mosques of Mecca and Medina, but in reality is a almost medieval-style brutal government system in which thrives on oppression and on bloodshed, and has shown time and again that they are not afraid to take lives, to torture, to murder, and even to commit mass murder, as they've been doing in Yemen. But of brutality, this has all kicked into a higher gear ever since MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, has come to de facto power. Of course, he's theoretically still just the crown prince, but in reality, as everyone knows, he is the actual power behind the throne of his father. And behind much of the new system that rules over Saudi Arabia.
Right.
The entire government consists mostly out of his cronies and his yes-men who follow his every command. And we have seen this when he starts imprisoning and even executing members of his own family, members of his own inner circle, when he starts persecuting people that were not even actually opposed to the Saudi monarchy in the past. most obvious and most famous case in point being Jamal Khashoggi himself, who, let's be honest, was not really a massive dissident. He was not, let's say, an Arab nationalist Republican or one of the members of the Shia resistance in the eastern regions of Saudi Arabia. Not at all. He was a man who had a long history and a long contour of service in service of the Saudi monarchy. He just simply disagreed with the way things were being done under NBS, and that is what cost him his life. So there is definitely, there should not be a shock or should not be a surprise when you see that this man got basically tortured to death and sawn into pieces on diplomatic grounds in a foreign country. This is something that sounds absolutely ridiculous, and it does, unless, of course, you realize, until you realize that this was Mohammed bin Salman was pulling the rope and who was ordering this. This is exactly, completely according to his modus operandi. This is how this man, unfortunately, who is in charge of one of the biggest economies in the world, this is how this man operates. This is how this man has worked for years.
Now, Daniel, in terms of human rights violations, the Saudis have a long record as well, and that includes repressing the minorities in their own eastern province, like Bresh also rightly mentioned, and also taking the lives of women and children in Yemen, yet they are removed from the UN child killer list. Let's have your comments.
Again, all this is very politicized. What is good for some countries is not good for others. We've seen, for example, now the ICC has announced in terms of its investigation into human rights abuses during the war in Afghanistan, it is not going to investigate the instigator of the war in Afghanistan, the United States. It appears that the rich and powerful countries are able to evade justice as well as their allies, while poorer and less powerful countries cannot. I think the other thing that needs to be pointed out, it's no coincidence that it just came out that the CIA itself, I believe it was now, we learned in 2017, hatched a plan to kidnap and kill Julian Assange, a journalist that has been critical of the United States. And so the killing of Khashoggi is nothing averse even to the United States in terms of what it does. So again, none of this is surprising, but we see these double standards being applied all the time.
Rich, let's have your comment on that too. How could Saudis be removed from that blacklist of the United Nations as child killer state? There are proof, on the ground, and you know what I'm talking about. And the war is still going on.
Yes, it's exactly like has been mentioned. The United Nations, for all the good it has done and for all the lofty promise that it held and still holds, of course, it has, there has to be some sort of a national discussion, negotiation, and a way in which we try to prevent war. So obviously that there needs to be something like that in a modern day and age. But the United Nations was constructed originally and still maintains that premise, was constructed from the very start, when it began, of course, with appointing the permanent five members, when it began to give veto powers to the superpowers, which can override the democratic process of this international body. Obviously, we have had a slight democratization by the fact that now also countries that, like China, like Russia, of course, that are not walking necessarily the line, have a veto power as well, but this by itself does not make it more democratic. Now, when it comes to the ICC or the International Court of Justice, because the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, and when it comes to things such as the list of violators of children's rights, these are all matters that are very often discussed with focus groups, with lobby groups. And there is always a lot of pressure by the superpowers and a lot of money going on in circles such as this, unfortunately. And this is why we see this terrible perversion of justice taking place over and over again. It is surprising to me that after the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, that the United States has allowed the truth to even come out at all. There was originally, Donald Trump, of course, has been defending Saudi Arabia for a long time. But in my opinion, the fact that we even know, us as the non-initiated ones, so sure that Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the consulate, that by itself was a little bit, I think, of a threat that the United States released, because at that point, and even still now a bit, they have been afraid for quite a while now that they might be losing control of MBS, that MBS might be a little bit too much he's a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. I've already kind of made him lose face to the international community, but that's, unfortunately, that's where it stops. The United States will not go further yet. MBS is not yet one of those puppet rulers that the United States is willing to drop, like they have done, for example, with Saddam Hussein at a certain point, and where they dropped him completely. MBS is not at that point yet, because he still toes the line of U.S. imperialism. Mm-hmm. But because he tried to go a little bit too far in terms of what the United States wanted to allow, they allowed the CIA to leak these reports to confirm that, you know, MBS was behind it. But at this point, we see it's been 3 years to actually prosecute him for it. They have kind of hit him on the fingers a bit and said, you know, you have to watch out with what you're doing. But they are still shielding him from any actual physical repercussions and any actual punishment for the crimes that he has committed so far.
Okay. Now, Daniel, let's turn to the U.S. As a candidate ahead of the Democratic primaries in late 2019, in front of a large crowd of people, Joe Biden said, and I'm quoting it, that Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered, and I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. Almost 2 years ago, he was asked if he would punish senior Saudi leaders for the killing of Khashoggi, and he said yes, he would, and that the Saudis must pay the price. Yes, Saudis are paying the price, but they're paying the price of the U.S.-made weaponry they're using in Yemen.
Yeah, well, again, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think Biden, during the campaign, said a lot of things that he didn't mean and that he ended up retracting later. In this case, he knew he had to say something like that. He had to distinguish himself from Trump, trying to portray himself as somehow more committed to human rights. But I'm sure once he became president, people sat him down from the defense industry and said, you know, Saudi Arabia's Arabia is worth billions of dollars to the defense industry in terms of arms sales. And, you know, got him straight that he would not be able to go after Saudi Arabia for Khashoggi or to end the U.S. support on the Saudi war in Yemen, which, again, Biden had promised to do. So we see the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia to be pretty much seamless, regardless of who's in power. And let's remember, of course, in terms of the war in Yemen, that Obama began the support of the Saudi war in Yemen in 2015, when Joe Biden was vice president.
Right. Bresh, let's draw this comparison one more time. You know, former President Trump did openly support MBS and U.S. ties with Saudis at any price. But what about President Biden? He acts differently. He did not meet MBS personally. He had somebody else, security advisor, to meet him. But what's the outcome? What difference does it make? The outcome is that justice is not served. The U.S. is still selling arms to the Saudis and all that.
Yeah, for them, it's a game of optics. It's a game of propagandistic outlook. Mm. You need, for the United States system to survive, you need a form of discussion and a few points of diversion of divergence and a point of bickering between Republicans and Democrats on matters that, at the end of the day, are quite unimportant and don't touch the fundamental principles. We've seen that over and over again. The Democrats, they try to appeal to the more liberal-minded, the more quote-unquote progressive-minded people, whereas the Republicans try to appeal to the war hawks and the evangelical Zionists that exist, unfortunately, quite a lot in the United States. And that is what they've been playing at. Yeah, Joe Biden, he will say, you know, he can basically say, I have done something already. I don't meet with MBS personally. Does it matter at the end of the day? Of course not. But that's why Agnes Callamard, the former UN rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, she mentioned, she said, at the end of the day, nothing has fundamentally changed. The only thing that is different now is that the United States has admitted, has condemned in words what has happened and said, you know, this is not proper. But when then the matter came on to put personal sanctions against MBS, right. Personal sanctions, which is a very popular thing to do in the United States. They've been sanctioning hundreds of people over the past couple of years. The United States immediately said, no, we want to recalibrate. They use the term recalibrate our relations with Riyadh. We don't want to rupture it. So in reality, what does that mean? That means absolutely nothing will fundamentally change. And this is that game that I've been playing for decades. Indeed, has been said by Daniel, that the Democrats were involved in supporting the war in Yemen in the first place. Yes, the Republicans under Trump, they might have supported that war even more vigorously, and now Biden is trying to reel back the amount of support they want to give. They do right. the same thing with the Zionist entity all the time. Yes, Donald Trump has moved the capital, the embassy to Jerusalem, whereas Obama criticized, openly, officially criticized the West Bank settlement that Benjamin Netanyahu was doing. Did Obama actually do anything against Israel?
No.
Of course not. This is purely palaver. This is purely this talk and purely window dressing that
right.
they've been trying to do. And this is what we're seeing now as well.
Exactly. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at it in a different way. Also, Khashoggi maybe is not American citizen. What about 9/11 attacks in which lots of Americans lost their lives? We have this less didactic report coming out under the Biden administration, and families of victims are asking, for this. But still, you see the Saudis are just there, and it's proven fact that Saudis did play a role in that.
Yes, and even though that's true, and even in the face of these newly released documents, the U.S. press has done all it can to downplay the Saudi role in the 9/11 attacks. We know that 15 of the 19 attackers were from Saudi Arabia. We now know and have known for some time that Saudi diplomats played some role in supporting the attackers, as you say. And yes, thousands of Americans lost their lives. And yet Saudi Arabia was never punished in any way for this. In fact, we know that when George Bush canceled all flights, he grounded all flights United States after 9/11, at the same time he was flying out the family of bin Laden out of the country. So Saudi Arabia has not only not been punished by the U.S. for 9/11, it seems to have been rewarded for it, and that is quite shocking.
Mm-hmm. Bresch, former U.N. Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings and current Secretary General of Amnesty International, Agnes Callamard, you just mentioned, she's expressed disappointment in the Biden administration. She says that that's the U.S. authorities, have to be careful about their pretense of being concerned with human rights and democracy. Pretense of human rights. Spot on, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Of course, she says it in the typical careful language of a diplomat, but in reality, you can see it seep through, of course, the disappointment and the anger that is in her words and that she speaks here. And I think this is absolutely warranted. We've been, when you analyze matters that are happening, especially in West Asia, especially in the wars involving the United States, everything is so hypocritical. All the claims that the United States have done, the claims that they fight for human rights, that they fight for democracy, that even the claim that they are defending themselves against some sort of unknown international terrorist enemy. These are all lies, and everything is a very almost Orwellian way of speaking that the United States has been using for the past 20 years at least, because this is indeed, like Ms. Callamard said very aptly, just a pretense. They claim that they are looking out for human rights, but they're cozying up to the most rabid violators of human rights in the entire world. In fact, they're not just cozying up to them, they're actively helping them survive. Donald Trump said very correctly at a certain point, which I think might have been a Freudian slip on his behalf, in which he said that Saudi Arabia would not survive for just even for weeks if the United States were to withdraw
supporting them,
the support. They don't have the popular support amongst the people to keep this kingdom intact. So this is all part of a massive propaganda stunt that unfortunately still way too many people are falling for.
OK. Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this episode of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh and historian journalist Fresh Junkers in Hasselt. I've been your host, Behruz Medev.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Say, O Muhammad, to whom belongs the earth and whoever is in it, if you should know. They will say, to Allah, say, then will you not remember? Say, who is Lord of the seven heavens and Lord of the great throne? They will say, they belong to Allah. Say, then will you not fear him?
Brothers and sisters, we finished talking about the 83rd verse of this chapter, and we can now move on to the next couple of verses to be discussed. The 84th verse starts saying, قُلْ لِمَنِ الْأَرْضُ وَمَنْ فِيهَا إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. Say, whose is the earth and whosoever is in it, if you have knowledge? سَيَقُولُونَ لِلَّهِ. They will say, Allah's. قُلْ أَفَلَا تَذَكَّرُونَ. Say, will you not then remember? And then the next verse says,
قل من رب السماوات السبع ورب العرش العظيم. Say, who is the Lord of the seven heavens and the Lord of the mighty throne? سيقولون لله قل أفلا تتقون. They will say, Alas, say, will you not then keep from evil? Since the unbelievers and the polytheists were more afraid of the resurrection than anything else, they consequently avoided it. They avoided their responsibilities by making various kinds of excuses and using delicate tricks. The Holy Quran placed emphasis on resurrection and elaborately is going to explain it. So, in these verses under discussion, the Holy Quran refutes the faulty logic of the rejectors of resurrection with three arguments: Allah's ownership of the world of existence, His lordship, and His sovereignty over the whole world of existence. The conclusion is that from every aspect, Almighty Allah is capable of causing resurrection, and His justice and wisdom necessitate that the hereafter must be a reality after the end of this world. And the noteworthy point regarding these couple of verses is that in the answers to every one of the questions posed in these verses, the unbelievers confess that the reality of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as the Lord and Master is true, and they contradict their very attitude and belief.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. At first, the Holy Quran announces, قُلْ لِمَنِ الْأَرْضُ وَمَنْ فِيهَا إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. Say, whose is the earth and whosoever is in it, if you have knowledge? Here is their answer. سيقولون لله قل أفلا تذكرون. Say, will you not then remember? So, this clear answer is based on their innate disposition that testifies to the belief in Allah, the creator of the existence. As you may have noted, this answer is contradicting the egoistic claim that issue from their mouths. And because of this, the Holy Quran replies to them, أَفَلَا تَذَكَّرُونَ. Will you not then remember? After such a clear and explicit confession, how could they think that a human being's resurrection after death would be unlikely and beyond Almighty Allah's all-embracing power? So, in 84 and 85th verses of this chapter, we had a quick and short question and answer from the Prophet and the answer from the polytheists. Now let's move on to the next question.
the Holy Quran, is ordering that the unbelievers should be asked again by the Prophet, قُلْ مَنْ رَبُّ السَّمَاوَاتِ السَّبْعِ وَرَبُّ الْعَرْشِ الْعَظِيمِ. Say, who is the Lord of seven heavens and the Lord of mighty throne? سَيْقُولُونَ لِلَّهِ. They will say, Allah's. قُلْ أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Say, will you not then keep from evil? So, their answer, automatically out of their own innate monotheistic disposition and their belief in Allah as the creator of the whole existence, is this. It is Allah's. Whatever you say, it is Allah's, and we believe in it. But in spite of this explicit confession, they still do not fear Allah. They continue denying resurrection. Just like the previous verses, they continue to stay in transgression. They do not want to believe in the return of man to life again because of the very fact that they are completely afraid of it. So they are asked in response, أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Will you not then keep from evil? Meaning that if you try to keep yourselves from evil, you will find out the answer by your hearts and believe in the answer, although you know the answer, but you do not want to believe in it. So there is a little bit of difference between knowing and believing in something. Also, the word Rabb means an owner who intends to maintain and manage his state. And the word Arsh mentioned in the 86th verse is used to mean the throne of Allah, which is beyond the seven heavens, as the traditions suggest. Thank you for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza,
London.
Russian Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Friday, in the Italian capital, over 3,000 Alitalia workers staged a new protest against the government's decision to shut down Italy's flag carrier since 1947. Alitalia is to be replaced by a slimmed-down state-owned airline called ITA, Italia Trasporto Aereo, that is planned to take over many of its assets. For years, Alitalia workers have held protests trying to block the morphing operation, which base unions say will result in the loss of thousands of jobs.
8,000 jobs will be slashed under the deal. Furthermore, we estimate that three external workers for each sacked Alitalia employee will find themselves unemployed. This is social butchery. Our country should be ashamed. The plan is to take a competitor like Alitalia out to make things easier for Air France, British Airways and Lufthansa.
In practical terms, the government is wiping the national collective agreement off. Workers in the aviation industry will no longer have any protection. They will become on-call employees. It's a shame that our largest left-leaning party and the largest unions have opted to team up with neoliberal forces.
Last month, the EU competition regulators surprisingly approved the morphing of debt-stricken Alitalia into a smaller company, conceding that the new state-owned airline was not liable for repaying 900 million euros in illegal state aid received by its forerunner.
The demand is that we need Alitalia. Italy needs a flag company. That's why we are here. And ITA is not that.
The new ITA airline will operate with less than half of Alitalia's fleet of aircraft. Pilot and aircrew pay is set to be almost halved. ITA is reportedly set to introduce a new labor contract aimed at giving it greater flexibility and competitiveness.
The 74-year-old Italian flag carrier Alitalia is set to fly for the last time on October 15. On the same day, its new incarnation airline, ITA, will start operating with 2,800 employees. More than two-thirds of Alitalia's staff, however, will be laid off. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's Army Ground Forces on Friday launched a military exercise in the northwestern region close to the borders with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. The drill is codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, a reference to the 7th century Battle of Khaybar, in which Prophet Muhammad and his army of early Muslims foiled a plot hatched by Jewish tribes. Iran's Army Ground Forces commander, Brigadier General Qumars Haydari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haidari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however, reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including six children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Just above the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee, as many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion U.S. dollar losses occurred to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a bloc of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching, and also because the conditions of the virus taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The funeral prayers for one of the eight members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the eight were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They killed about eight people, which we are sure that not as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday. They carried away the dead bodies. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul. a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones. A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people.